Hello, and welcome to the Brighter Thinking Pod from Cambridge University Press. My name is Adam, and I'm one of the producers on the pod. Before we get started with today's topic, I want you to imagine the time you'd save if you had classroom assessments that mark themselves. Assessments that adapt to every student's abilities and aptitudes. I'm talking about testing that's suitable for all ages with the power to reveal individual strengths and struggles. This technology frees you to teach, gives you more insight than ever before, and allows you to set motivational goals for each of your students. Sound good? Okay, stop imagining. What I've just described are baseline assessments from the Centre for Evaluation and Monitoring. If you're interested in learning more, go to chem.org. That's C-E-M.org. Okay, let's get on with the pod.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Brighter Thinking Pod from Cambridge University Press with me, your host, Tamsin Hart. My role at the Press is Senior Marketing Executive for our science titles, so I'm really looking forward to discussing how to bring the real world into the STEM classroom here today. The Brighter Thinking Pod brings you bags of advice and conversation from some of our brighter thinkers, who are our authors, teachers, and academics, with a slice of entertainment on the side too. Today, we're going to be taking a closer look at bringing the real world into the STEM classroom, and we're joined by Michael Strachan, Deputy Head Academic at Repton School Dubai and author of Cambridge IGCSE Chemistry Practical Workbook and Teacher's Resource, and George Vlachonicholas, Head of Economics and Professional Tutor at Headington School, Oxford, and author of Cambridge International AS and A-Level Economics Teacher's Resource. Remember, all the links and info that we discuss are available in the show notes for your ease. And if you want to get your voice heard on the show, you can get in touch on Twitter using the hashtag BrighterPod or by email at educationmarketing@cambridge.org. Finally, please remember to like, review and subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on. So let's start by introducing our guests today. Hello, Michael and George.
Hello.
Hello.
Before we get on to our main theme today, we're going to start with a little icebreaker so our listeners can get to know our guests better. Let's take it back to your school days. Michael, could you please tell us a bit about your favourite teacher?
Thank you very much, Tamsin. So my favourite teacher was Mr. Stedden, who was my science teacher when I was in year seven at secondary school. And he was a science teacher straight out of central casting, a big shock of white hair over his head, a big bushy moustache under his nose, always wearing a lab coat that was dirty, covering chemicals, chalk, etc. And he created a fantastic environment for me and the other boys in our year seven science classroom. Every lesson was practical work. Every lesson, something fantastic was happening. Very little writing going on, but lots and lots of experimentation. Every day we look forward to our science lessons and the kind of, we learn so much in the chaos. And I think a large part of the reason why I'm a science teacher today is down to the fun that we had all the way back then.
Fantastic. And George, what about you?
Yeah, so I've chosen two teachers actually, a guy called David Brunton and another one, Angus Grant. David was my English teacher, probably in years 9 and 10. And then Angus was my economics teacher, actually, in years 12 and 13. Just to pick up stuff that Michael was saying there, he said he was looking forward to every lesson. That's exactly what I had written down as well. I was looking forward to their lessons. I saw them as fun. If I think about it, I can't really remember any particular set piece activity that was what was driving me to class. It was just more the relationship, how they made me feel when I was in class. It was fun. It was interesting. They treated us with respect and treated us like adults, even though we weren't adults at the time. It just had a really, really good relationship. And with David, with English, I didn't take English onto A-level, but I just remember loving that classroom and the environment that he created. And obviously Angus in economics probably inspired me to take it onto university. And eventually, look, I followed him into his career as an economics teacher.
Brilliant. Now for the questions. Let's find out a little bit more about you first. So, George, what's your experience as a STEM educator?
Sure. So I've been teaching now for the best part of a decade. Before teaching, I was actually in the army, which doesn't necessarily cross over that well, but I think I've managed to take some of the things that I've learned from the army into my teaching experience. So in those 10 years, I have changed school only once, two different settings. I've been a teacher of economics and then now head of economics. But in the last few years, I've also been professional tutor, which is another name basically for ITT coordinator. So I'm responsible for the induction of new teachers at the school, taking them through pre-PGCE, PGCE, and then post-PGCE courses. So I found it really, really interesting in my own personal career now to get a really great experience of going into not just STEM, but lots of classrooms around the school and seeing what it is that people do in different departments.
Fantastic. And Michael, what about you?
Well, as you can see from the video, I've got a bit more grey hair than George, so I've been teaching a little bit longer, so I'm 16 years in now. I started out teaching science in the UK, a couple of years in Kent, and then a couple of years in Southeast London, before moving to Qatar, where I worked as head of biology, head of science, and then finally assistant head of teaching and learning. And then I moved across to Dubai 6 years ago to take that post, first as head of science, and then as deputy head academic. And my remit involves teaching and learning, assessment, curriculum. But even though I'm SLT and I've joined the dark side, I still very much teach. I have a good amount of teaching each week, and I wouldn't want to stop teaching even if I became a head teacher. I think it's essential for the kind of the most imaginative and greatest teachers to be involved in carrying on teaching and not just hiding behind desks.
Brilliant, thank you. A wide range of experience between you both there. Now, to really get into our topic, why should we care about this? Michael, what's the importance of real-life examples to learning science?
Well, we're so lucky as scientists, and no offence here, George, but for science teachers, the universe is our textbook. My wife is an English teacher, and she's a fantastic teacher, and she often gives me poems and things to look at. And there's a fantastic poem by Walt Whitman, which I won't recite now, called The Learned Astronomer. And the gist of the poem is that, you know, we can get bogged down in facts and figures and tables, etc. But the learned astronomer bores his students. And the ending of the poem is the student going out and looking up at the night sky in awe and wonder and seeing how fantastic the universe is. And so the key thing is, for me, in terms of science education, making sure that we don't lose that awe and wonder of the universe, the natural world, and get too bogged down in facts, figures and books.
Fantastic. And what about economics with you, George?
Yeah, economics, like other STEM subjects, I think lend themselves to real world experiences. In so many ways, and I just think it's really, really important to have purpose as a central theme for your teaching, regardless of the age group that you're teaching. What is the purpose of doing this particular lesson? What are the purposes of these particular lesson objectives? I think with science and other subjects, sometimes it's possible that you could teach it all in the abstract, but at some point, if you do that, you're just going to lose your class, because they won't see the relevance to what they're doing in their real life. So I think we are duty bound really to explore those real world examples, because we want to show the purpose of our subject to the students that we're teaching, so that we can have I love Michael's phrase there, the awe and wonder of our subject. They can see the usefulness to them. In terms of abstract learning, I think perhaps as I've got older, I've enjoyed the abstract more, and I like deep diving into that. But I can remember being a 12 and 13 year old that I wasn't interested in that at all. I always wanted to see the direct relevance. So the other thing I would just add there is, when we talk about real world experience, which I think is vitally important, I also think it's important for teachers to realise, what is the real world experience of my students? Because a 12-year-old's real world isn't necessarily the teacher's real world. So it is important for us at the same time to really try and drill down into, well, what are my class thinking about? What are the potential issues that they have? What are they seeing in the world? And how can my subject best fit them?
Fantastic. Yeah, I love the idea of bringing in awe and wonder into the classroom. But do you think there are potential pitfalls and challenges in doing this as well? What do you think, George?
So whenever I've had these conversations with people before, and I've talked about fun in the classroom and making things enjoyable and purposeful for the students, I think some people can look at that and worry that they might lose the academic rigour behind the subject. but I don't see this as binary. I mean, whilst, okay, I want to make a particular activity fun and interesting because I want to bring the kids into the classroom and make them want to come to my lessons, that doesn't have to lose the academic rigor with it as well. I think that's just the challenge for teachers to both get the enjoyment, but also get the academic learning behind it as well. So in a STEM classroom full of experiments, do those experiments, but create them in such a way that kind of creates fun alongside learning. So for example, in the first 3 weeks of economics this year, I've been doing many science experiments to prove how we derive the demand curve or how we derive the supply curve. And it's involved kids running up and down from point A and point B in my classroom to try and move Lego from one side to the other. Or it's a hypothetical scenario in which they're playing a game with each other and essentially using game theory and numbers. But there's a competitive element, there's a fun element, and then we can draw on those experiences to get the academic rigor as well.
Fantastic. Michael, are you finding any challenges in bringing the real world in?
I don't necessarily think there are challenges because science is quite easy. And I really agree with what George was saying there about the fact that it's not what's relevant to us and our real life and our real world is absolutely relevant to what a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old is experiencing. And those two are absolutely different worlds. And when you think now the distractions that the students are dealing with, the distractions in their lives, the constant, you know, text messages, WhatsApps, all that kind of thing, the ability to hold the attention and interest of a younger student is much more difficult than it was way back when I was at school with Mr. Fedden, for example. In terms of pitfalls, it has to be authentic. We can shoehorn the real world in. This is one of the things that happens sometimes with resources and textbooks on occasion, where the real world example is kind of popped in there as a bit of a kind of a tick box exercise. So I think that the children will sniff that out fairly quickly. It has to be authentic and a real application, not just done for the sake of putting the real world into a lesson. And I think what George said about the abstract is, as students get older, it's absolutely right. We can be a bit more abstract, but younger now, with the younger students, we have to make sure that we're linking that to real concrete examples and things I would have had experience of.
Yeah, if I could pick up on that, Tamsin, as well. I think Michael's use of the phrase is authenticity. That kind of correlates with my own sort of honesty and just, again, relationship building with your students, understanding what it is that your students want from this subject as well. So that these links that you're making in the real world, again, I think Michael's absolutely right. We shouldn't be making links for the sake of making links. These tenuous links are not authentic and students will pick up on that. But on the other hand, we shouldn't just take that as we shouldn't make any links, therefore. It's just more of a challenge for us to find, well, what are the links that will work that have both the authenticity but also stimulate interest, stimulate the awe and wonder, to come back to that lovely phrase.
If I could just jump in again, sorry, Tamsin, but I think a fantastic point George made there. It's the relationships. To know what's relevant to a 12 or 13-year-old, what's going to interest a 14-year-old, you have to know those students. You have to actually know what they're interested in, because it's very difficult as someone who's, you know, 20, 30 years older than they are to kind of know that. So actually knowing your students and having that positive relationship where you can ask them questions about their interests and their life experiences to find out about them is key, absolutely key.
Now, you've both mentioned age there a few times. So, Michael, do you think this works effectively across different age ranges of learners?
Children are interested in the real world from, you know, the youngest ones you teach. I've taught some junior school children aged 5 and 6, all the way up to year 13. I just think, and I think George mentioned this before, it's that nuance of changing the kind of the pitch and how abstract or you know, real it is. But definitely, that, you know, reading a newspaper and bringing a story from outside of the school into the lesson works very, very well with sixth form students, especially if you can read to the universities they're interested in. So there's a bit of research coming out from Cambridge or something from Oxford. You link to that in your lesson, and because they're looking to go to those sorts of institutions, that's a fantastic hook to get them really interested. That wouldn't work with a year 7 year 8 student because they're not really looking at that, but it might be something from the news or something from a TV program would link in quite nicely. The Olympics happened fairly recently. That was quite a nice hook for lots of science lessons. So things are really relevant, but just changing the pitch and how we present that is the key there.
What have been your experience, George? Have you found that to be true?
Yeah, I mean, most of my career has been at the higher end for A-level students, so year 12 and year 13. And therefore, with that age range, you can do those things like independent study skills, setting them off on research tasks, safe in the knowledge that they at least know how to use Google effectively, how they can access proper information, how they can also think critically about the sources of information that they're using. Whereas I think the lower you go down the age groups, you just have to be mindful of, again, their age and exactly what it is that you can expect from a 12 and a 13-year-old in terms of independent research skills. I do think sometimes there can be a little bit of lost time and a lost learning if you're setting presentation activities for that sort of age group. Are you really getting this, the information that you want, or are you setting them in an activity that you think you ought to, rather than actually hitting those learning objectives that you were meant? I think there's great examples of setting, to take it away from STEM for a moment, but great examples of setting history presentation exercises on, you know, the Great Fire of London. And what you get back is just a series of bullet point facts that they've taken, copied and pasted from the internet. Well, that wasn't really the aim of the exercise. So maybe the academic presentation wasn't the best activity to roll with. So in that sense, maybe a role play in class, or maybe some sort of collective reading activity where you're reading through sources in class is the better one to go to. I think all activities have their place. I just think it's the challenge for the teacher to match the activity with the age group that they're teaching at the time.
Now, you mentioned independent research skills there. Now, it got me thinking about remote learning during the pandemic. And do you think that brought an extra challenge, or did it lend itself to bringing real examples? What do you think, George?
So I think we were encouraged to send students away with independent research activities to try and take them away from the screen. But of course, most of the time you're doing that, then you're almost sending them back onto a screen because you're sending them articles to go away and read, whether that's Google or whether it's more academic like JSTOR or something like that. But I think it was pretty difficult unless they had a textbook at home. But again, even with the textbook at home, you're fairly limited in the content that they can actually access. So whilst I think it was a great idea, I'm not sure it worked terribly well in practice. And there were more than a few limitations to what could be achieved.
Did you find that to be the case, Michael?
Absolutely. Yeah, I echo what George has said there. It was very, very difficult. We had the kind of issue as well that although the students were at home and did have textbooks, etc., there was a strong expectation from parents that, you know, the students should be engaged. Here in Dubai, we were live teaching from kind of week two or three, I think it was, and offered live teaching all the way through for students accessing work remotely. And so because of that pressure from parents and also the issues that raised by George, you're kind of trying to set them independent work, but they would then just be straight back on the screen. And there was a big drive here, especially in terms of well-being, to make sure students weren't spending 8, 9, 10 hours a day looking at the screen. So there was a bit to the age range. Older students you could trust to be a bit more judicious with their time and maybe self-regulate their screen time a bit. What we didn't want to do is set a task and then have a little year 7 or 8 spending 12 hours staring at a screen researching something. So we think the pressure and the benefits of direct instruction during that remote learning period was something that was key for us to make sure we limited as much the independent work as possible.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I'd like to bring everything you've said together, really, now, George. What's your advice for bringing these examples most effectively into the classroom?
In my observations of certain STEM subjects, quite often I've observed lots of scaffolding in teachers' teaching. So, for example, the whole thing seems to be leading up to the experiment so that you've got a good solid platform of knowledge, and then you can apply it to the experiment, and then hopefully you can make conclusions. And I completely understand the reasons for doing that. Sometimes I think you could go a different way, though, which is to just do the experiment in the first place without actually giving any knowledge about anything. Do the experiment, try and work out then, almost working backwards, to try and work out what all those knowledge points were before. And it's what I quite like about that. I would call this immersion. And this is something I have brought out from my own experiences in the army, where the army is very good at throwing you in at the deep end. So I would call this an immersion tactic, which is throw the students in at the deep end from time to time, take away the scaffolding, and see if they can kind of piece it back together. And the big benefit of doing this is I think you're right in at the top of the higher order thinking skills, right at the start of the lesson, rather than working your way up systematically. Now, I don't think you can do that for every topic. I don't think you could do that necessarily for every lesson. But every now and again, I don't think that's a bad idea to just throw it in there, just to see what the students are capable of. And you may even find that they prefer it, and you might even prefer it because it immediately puts you at that higher plane of thinking.
What are your thoughts, Michael?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that there's definitely a time and a place for direct instruction. One of the things I've been working with quite a lot recently is cognitive load theory. And actually, if you do put students in the deep end, they are trying to deal with the subject content and the skills at the same time. And that might overload them somewhat, so they then don't focus on necessarily the learning. They're just trying to get a task done. So you couldn't do it all the time. However, I absolutely agree with George. Now and again, I think it is very, very good. And if we're going to focus on skills, the student's skills as scientists, rather than just their content and their understanding, it's great to have a really unscaffolded, a really open lesson where the students are choosing the variables. One of the things when I'm doing teacher training across the Middle East region is there are four types of kind of practical. The practical where the teacher dictates, you know, what we're changing, what we're doing. It's very, very didactic. Then we give the children a little bit more freedom in terms of they maybe can change some variables. Then they can, you know, they can choose what they're measuring. But the kind of Nirvana is where the students are choosing all the variables, they're choosing which equipment to use, the whole thing is at their hands. And the sad thing is, when I ask teachers in the room, you know, how often do we do type one, lots of hands go up, how often type two, how often do we type three and four, and the best one, the one where they're learning the most, is the one that's least frequently attempted. I think this is kind of the one that George is describing there, where again, we just throw them at the deep end. And the reason is, that's the point where there's the greatest risk of chaos and failure. And we know that failure is a fantastic way to learn. And I think lots of teachers are very afraid of the lesson going awry and going wrong. And so they shy away from that kind of chaotic, if you will, type of practical work for much safer type one, where they're controlling everything and demonstrating everything. But it's because, and I think, you know, nail on the head there, George, that, you know, we have to make sure that we don't do that all the time, because as I mentioned with cognitive load theory, students can be overwhelmed. But occasionally, to kind of focus on skills and thinking like a scientist, what I say to my students is, you know, Newton didn't have a method sheet when he was doing his practicals. You know, he had to kind of think about these things from an absolute, you know, first principles. And so occasionally, when I want my students to really focus on developing their skills as a scientist, their, you know, really high-level thinking skills, then, yeah, chuck them at the deep end. And you know, it might go wrong. I've had lots of disastrous lessons where, you know, things haven't worked as they should have done, etc. But in terms of the learning, next time we come to do something, the students understand why they have to measure the volume of a particular liquid, why they have to weigh the mass before and after. And I think as a learning experience, that's a bit deeper than them just kind of, you know, working through a method sheet. One of my favorite phrases of my students, if any of them listen to this, will know is, I always shout out, we're not doing cookery here. And that's the thing. No offense to cookery, I think it's fantastic, but they need to be just not just following a set menu and a set sheet. They have to be thinking about why they're doing each thing. And that really happens when you kind of cut away all the scaffolding and let them have a go themselves.
Brilliant.
So yeah, do you mind if I just add my two pennies worth as well? I think there's probably more, but there's two implied tasks that I think come out of Michael's discussion there. One is planning. I do find with a lot of initial teacher training that is almost too much focus on planning. And I know that sounds weird, because obviously we do want teachers to think about their lessons and plan their lessons, but I don't think we need to get teachers planning them to the nanosecond. And I think sometimes the PGCE almost encourages teachers to do that. Whereas I actually think, well, if you've got a main effort and you've got an aim to your lesson and you know what the lesson objectives are, that idea of a chaotic lesson, Michael, I think sometimes they're the best lessons, the chaotic lessons. And fine, you do need to spend the 5 minutes at the end having a plenary and pulling it all together. But what a great experience of having, you know, these disparate kind of groups in the classroom doing slightly different things and you walking around the classroom and trying to point people in the right directions. That sounds like, you know, the sort of class I want to teach, rather than standing at the front and telling everybody all the answers. But I think another implied task of that is you are relying on your teachers to have really great subject matter knowledge. Those sorts of lessons, I think, can only really be run if you are very, very confident in your knowledge and you are prepared for people to go in different directions. Once you start going around and seeing what they're all doing, you can guide them in kind of informative ways of getting them back on track. But again, you'll only do that if you're very, very confident in your own subject matter knowledge. So I think there's an implied task there that all teachers, regardless of the subject, you want to make sure that you're confident with the learning material.
If I could come in, Tamsin, if George Mason had been a national teacher training, and one of the things, we had lots of NQTs in my time, and one of the things, there's a famous quote, no battle plan lasts first contact with the enemy. And I say to him, you know, planning is great, and lesson planning is great, but actually it's never going to go exactly, they're never going to spend exactly 5 minutes on the starter activity and then 25 minutes on the practical. And some of the best lessons I've seen in my career is where things have gone slightly differently, away from the lesson plan, and the teacher's just gone with that and actually embraced it and actually gone in that direction. And some of the worst lessons, unfortunately, I've seen is where things are going completely wrong, and the teacher doesn't care and just sticks to the lesson plan all the way through, when at any point they could have gone off in different directions and saved the lesson. So I think lesson plan is good, but a lesson plan is it shouldn't be adhered to exactly. I think the planning process is brilliant to think through what could go wrong and what could go right, but then the kind of sticking to a plan, above all else, is the recipe for ruin, I think, especially for early career teachers.
So it seems to me what you're talking a little bit about here is reading a class or a teacher's ability to listen to what's going on when you're diverting from a plan. What do you think about that, Michael?
Absolutely. It's seeking that feedback from the students. Linking back to what George mentioned about, you know, you have to have very, very secure subject knowledge as a teacher to be able to do that. I think linking back to behaviour management as well, and you'd have to have that class, you know, where you want them eating out the palm of your hand, to be kind of frank, because if you're going to be a little bit chaotic and have a bit more freedom, then you need to be able to pull them back when you need to. But yeah, it's definitely and listening, you know, there are certain activities that I've planned. I think the kids will love this. This will be phenomenal. And then when we actually do the activity, that there's not the interest there, and it's better then to abandon that and try something else. And equally, sometimes a student, and most of my best bits of lessons have come from students just asking a brilliant question, and stopping everyone to stop and let, you know, little Tommy ask that question again. And what do we think about that question? And then a debate flourishes from there. So yeah, absolutely, being in the room and listening is key.
What do you think, George?
Yeah, I agreed. I'll take it in a slightly different direction as well, which is if you do have these relationships with your students, and I dare say that is easier said than done when you've got classes of 10 as opposed to classes of 30. But if you do have those relationships with your class, and you know them, you've talked to them, I think you can almost anticipate those real life examples that are happening in the world today that probably will resonate with them. So to give you an example, just something we've been doing today in the UK at the moment, we've got the political party conferences happening. And it's quite clear to me that there are a lot of students who are watching those speeches going on outside of school, which is great, they're involved. But what I've really tried to do in the last few lessons is say, okay, well, what is the leader of the Labour Party saying that we should do with taxes? And what is it that the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the Conservative Party is talking about what we should do with fiscal policy? So I know they're doing it. So I've almost taken it upon myself to also have a look at what's going on those party political conferences, because I wouldn't have done if my students hadn't been doing that. And I've almost tried to work out, well, all right, how can I bring this into my lesson? So it's looking at what is interesting them. And then that might give you an insight into what will make interesting real life experiences. And it might not be there and then in flight in the classroom now, but it might be in 3 or 4 lessons time.
Brilliant. Now, Michael, you mentioned cognitive load theory, and I wonder if you might expand or define that for some of our newer teachers who might be listening.
Sure. So it kind of, the theory centres around the idea that we have a basic amount of information we can process at any given time, and that if there are different formats of information, written information, visual information, verbal information, that adds to the load. And once we get to a certain point, it then becomes very difficult for any learning to take place. And to cope with that amount of information, certain aspects of learning are reduced or diminished or shut down. And so if we have students coming into a room where we suddenly show them a video and they have to read a piece of text, and they're doing a practical and reading at the same time, all those things then will probably impinge on their ability to learn effectively. So sometimes it's about what we strip out, what we don't put into a lesson, so that we enable the learners to refocus in on the key aspects we're trying to, and also the methodology. What method are we giving the students the information? Is it overloading them with too many different sources at the same time? It's very easy to say, right, we're going to read from the textbook now, and then you're reading that to the students while they're reading it themselves. That could overload them. So it's better to strip it down. So, right, we're all going to sit in silence for 5 minutes and read this passage from the textbook. Right, we're going to stop there. Now I'm going to speak to you for the next 5 minutes. We're going to stop there. Now you're going to discuss with the next person. Rather than having a free-for-all with lots of different things coming at the students from different directions. We have to remember that students, they spend 55 minutes an hour doing chemistry, then they rush off and do English, then they go off and do economics, then they go off and do maths. We're doing our subject, by and large, all day long, the same subject. And so thinking about that as well, that over the course of a day, they could have, you know, six different subjects, IGCSE, three or four different subjects at IB or A level, being cognizant of that and the pressure that puts them under. So yeah, one of the things that I've tried to do is really strip out. When I was a teacher, I would put lots and lots of animations in PowerPoints and have video clips, etc. But I kind of try and think now, actually, how much information, what's the minimum amount of information I can give them for them to achieve what they need to achieve this lesson, rather than just throwing in the kitchen sink. And I'm embarrassed sometimes when I find PowerPoints that I made when I was kind of 1 or 2 years in as a teacher with, you know, animations and little kind of clip arts and little embedded videos and GIFs and audio clips. And I think this is just far too much. I was too much of an overkill for the students. So it's just making sure we're not overloading them when it comes to learning, because it's a difficult process. We forget how much, you know, it's easy for us. We understand the subject knowledge we've been doing all our lives. But for a lot of these students, it's their first time on a topic. And so we have to understand it's not as easy for them as it is for us when we cover this subject content.
And what's your feelings on that, George?
Yeah, well, the way I've had this described to me is, I've not heard it cognitive load theory, but it's kind of working memory versus long-term memory. And the idea that we just have a finite capacity of working memory, and once we've reached it, there isn't anything else going on. So, I think it is the challenge for all teachers to kind of, well, as you put it, read the room earlier, read the room, see what's happening, where are they in terms of their working memory, how many things are they dealing with at this current amount of time? And I'm with Michael. I'd rather strip things down and boil it down to its bare essentials. What is it that I want them to know? And almost allow them to then go and explore the things that interest them off the back of those key activities. One of the things I've been interested in recently is graphic organization tools. So how can we essentially boil any idea down to a single graphic or a single, not just mind maps, but mind maps are an example. How can we essentially convey our information as quickly as possible? Don't want to relate everything back to my previous military experience, but the army was very good at that. Yeah, in the chaos of war, we just need an acronym, or we need a mnemonic. And then people can go to that. They've freed up the headspace for everything else that's going wrong on. I think that's a great tactic for any teacher to have in their toolbox.
So you've both given me some really great examples today, but could you, Michael, give me one great example that teachers can take away to think about of bringing the real world into the STEM classroom?
Yes, I can. One of the things we mentioned earlier on in the podcast was making things relevant to the students' lives. And being an international educator, it isn't just what's relevant to a 12-year-old, it's relevant to a 12-year-old in a particular culture. So I was teaching in Qatar some Qatari boys physics a number of years ago. And one of the things we were teaching was pressure and how to calculate pressure. And so I went through my usual kind of array of examples. We did compare an elephant's foot and a stiletto heel, but it just wasn't going in. The idea of, you know, having a greater area of reducing the pressure just didn't work at all. And so I kind of spent a few days thinking about it. And one of the biggest pastimes in Qatar is off-road driving and driving in the sand dunes. And one of the things that happens there is we have to let air out of the tyres. And so I kind of took the students out into the car park, and we let the air out of the tyres on my car. Luckily I had a pump to pump it afterwards, but we kind of let the air out. And I was, oh, my uncle does this, my uncle does it. And suddenly they were all talking about this, and they then began discussing what was the best PSI to have. And after that concrete example that linked to their lives, back in the classroom, they whizzed through the calculations. It was straightforward because it was just, we're talking about tyres, and that makes sense. Of course you have to let out the tyres to have a bigger area, and the car will float on the sand, so to speak. But it took a bit of thinking, and it's in cultural awareness sometimes, especially as an international educator. You have to think of not just a 12-year-old, but a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old in this particular culture. And sometimes you have three or four different kind of key cultures in the class. And so it's being mindful of that and not just relying on the same old bag of tricks that you've taught previously. And I'm sure in the future there'll be other examples that will have to do with different cultures and ages of students that I teach. But that worked really well. And it's something I still use that example now here in Dubai, and it still resonates with many of the students here.
Brilliant. Thank you. And George, do you have a good example for us to take away?
Yeah, sure. I think one of my mantras in my classroom is that economists love data. So to think about it from a kind of STEM point of view, I'm very, very keen, almost in every lesson, to put some form of quantitative data in front of my students. I want to preface this by saying I don't think you need to be a math ninja to succeed at economics at A level or IB. But nevertheless, at some stage, you're going to have to deal with quantitative data and analyze it in some way to come up with sensible conclusions. So I'm very, very keen always to put data in front of students. And I guess what I ask them to do is play the role of an economist. Let's imagine that you've just collected this data. Let's imagine that you've just been given this data. What would an economist say, having looked at this data? What are the conclusions that we can make? And I think that's quite a powerful tool because, again, you're not necessarily saying what it is that you're looking for. You're almost inviting them to make their own conclusions about what it is that they think is in front of them. To give you another example, one of the things I'm looking to be teaching in the next few weeks is this thing called the balance of payments. Now, if you've ever taught economics, this is the worst part of the course. It's very difficult to get across what exactly it is. It's essentially a form of accounting. But teachers don't like teaching it and students hate learning it. But one of the most successful ways that I've come across, I've tried to do teaching it is actually getting them to play the role of the accountant. So here is the data that somebody working on the balance of payments would have. Now you be the accountant. Here's your spreadsheet. Go and populate the spreadsheet with the data and let's see what comes out. And so something that potentially is quite bland and very abstract and doesn't necessarily show its purpose immediately, hopefully I can try and get my students to the point where they do see the purpose of it by actually role-playing that job of being the accountant. And I think that then makes the links to why this is important, what its role in real life is. It makes it easier because they've actually done the job. They've actually engaged with the data in front of them so they can see almost for themselves why it's important in the first place.
Brilliant. Some great examples there. So looking at your local environment, thinking about your local culture, so really reading your class, and also taking it to role play, so really acting it out to bring understanding. Some fantastic examples there. Thank you. So it just remains for me to say thank you very much to George Vlachonicholas and Michael Strachan for joining me today. Michael and George, do you either have Twitter handles or any place you'd like people to find out about you, any publications you'd like to mention? George, how about you?
So I'm afraid I'm not on Twitter, but I do have a LinkedIn account. So if anybody wants to get hold of me, that's probably the place to do it. And yeah, just to say that I have a book out called From Camouflage to Classroom, and it is all about my my own sort of self-autobiographical story from going from the military and into teaching and taking all the military principles into my teaching, essentially what I've made of it.
Fantastic. And how about you, Michael?
So I am on Twitter. I'm a bit of a lurker, though. I don't post too much, but I am there as at StrachHacks. And in terms of publications, the new edition of the IGCSE Chemistry Workbook for Students Practical Guide came out a little while ago, but the new Teacher's Guide should be coming out in the next month or so as well. So if people are chemistry teachers and looking for hints and tips of how to deliver chemistry in innovative ways, that will be out fairly shortly.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, both. And that's all for our How to Bring the Real World into the STEM Classroom episode. Don't forget to tell your friends about us and rate our show on whatever platform you're listening on. Our show notes have lots of useful links that we've discussed throughout the show and what Michael and George have just said now. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter at CUP Education or use the hashtag BrighterThinking to respond, you can also email us at educationmarketing@cambridge.org. So it's goodbye from myself and goodbye from George and Michael.
Goodbye.
Cheerio.
Goodbye.